order this May the 23rd, 2006. I'd like to welcome everyone here today. We have a busy agenda and some good work to do. I attended the subcommittee this morning on serious events, and it was an interesting discussion. And this afternoon we're going to have the report of our first report of our subcommittee, and I'm going to turn that over to Representative Boone, who will give her report on the Natural Disaster Subcommittee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Our committee has had two subcommittee meetings, and I have to point out in the audience is my constituent, Gus Meyer from Tillamook, who has attended all of them and many of the subcommittee meetings of this full committee, and he's here today. So he keeps me honest and is a great help locally because he serves on the local emergency preparedness committee. Okay. And I'm going to just read through it so you have a copy of it here. The Subcommittee on Natural Disasters held two meetings, one in Cannon Beach in February, to gather information and identify areas in which legislative action would enhance citizen preparation, local capacity, and emergency response to natural disasters. The next step will be for the subcommittee to meet on July 25th to receive public comment on potential recommendations, review cost estimates, and discuss final legislative concepts for recommendation to the Joint Committee on Emergency Preparedness. I just want to say we'll be covering a couple other subjects there, too, that we haven't had a chance to, which is fire and volcanoes and, I think, earthquakes.
Mm-hmm.
Most concepts will apply to all types of disasters. The recommendations are grouped by actions necessary prior to a disaster, during an event, and post-disaster response. These actions are based on the recognition that Oregon cannot count on nor wait for federal funding, and that citizens need to be personally prepared to survive without government assistance until the area is accessible by emergency responders. Additional recommendations below may be considered by the subcommittee on July 25th based on member suggestions and additional information gained through the Pacific Peril Transportation Disaster Response and Recovery Exercise being conducted this week, and it's actually starting tomorrow, or today. It's today, tomorrow, and Thursday in Warrenton at Camp Rylea. And ODOT and Federal Transportation, many local representatives will be there, and some, I know Clatsop County Health Department's even going to be there because they are interested in how they're going to get their medical supplies through. So, and these are some of the things that we talked about, legislative concepts, actions to support a pre-disaster preparation. That is to create a clear chain of emergency chain of command structure, to delineate responsibilities of the various jurisdictions, city, county, metro, state, federal, to avoid gaps or duplications, and to make most effective use of resources. Encourage mutual aid agreements between jurisdictions, and many of these are already being done locally. So it'll be, and I'm trying to reach out to my local jurisdictions and special districts, fire districts, and other emergency districts, so that they are connected to what we're doing here and that we kind of stay on track. And I think that'll come out as one of the recommendations, that we all do that, so we're not going different. Thank you. And I sound like Carl Castle because I have this tooth thing in, so it's... create and fund public outreach coordinator positions to canvass citizens to assess needs, different needs that are in coastal, rural, and urban inland areas, and provide information regarding disaster risks, identifying disasters in progress, safety zones, household and business preparedness. And this is something that we have had a small mention of in this committee, and I've tried to track down the person who did it for the city of Seaside on a grant basis, and she actually came to the legislature last session and gave a report. They had to the OCZMA had a meeting here. I remember that in April, last April, before this last 2005, and It was so simple, it was incredible. It was a person who was hired to do this training of neighbors to go door to door, identify who lived near you, take responsibility for your neighbors and family, and just making sure everybody knew what the plan was. And Seaside recently, about a month ago, had another drill, and it was mainly for the schools. And it was in what had happened from the very beginning of all this talk of tsunami till now. And the schools have practice and practice. And then when the sirens went off, it was just chilling to see all the people just coming inland from the coast on in Seaside, on the boardwalk, on in. Some of the business people were a little bit slow to respond because they were locking up and doing things like that. But the kids all streamed out of the school, went on up to the hill and got to their point. And we got up there and we couldn't see the kids. And they were walking all around the hills. But they were in the safe zone and they stood up there, and it took a good hour before they cleared it. And it worked well. And it was all because of this neighbor-to-neighbor contact.
Isn't Seaside one of the disaster-ready cities in Oregon?
Yeah, uh-huh. And they've been working on this for quite a while, because we are, if you took a map, and we saw this in our committee, when was it? The first one, I think, or last one here, the picture of the Abu in Indonesia. You could almost overlay that in so many of the cities along the coast, Rockaway Beach in my district and Seaside, Gearhart, and I'll tell you, I just got back into clam digging, and it's all I can do to prepare myself psychologically to go out onto the beach, knowing there's no way I can get off in time, but I just am obsessed with getting clams, so that works.
You just got to make sure you're ready to meet your maker.
Yeah, that's it. And I wear swimmable clothes.
And if the dirt moves, you move.
That's right. Yeah, that is so true. But the kids know it now, and this is one small city, but it's going to be one small city at a time. So let me go on here and. Where did I go? It'll encourage business participation, disaster response planning and training, as well as business continuity plans, and that's important. And the local chambers are working on these things locally.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I heard this lady make a presentation in Florence one time when I was there. Mm-hmm. Did you call the city of Seaside to find out who she is, where she is?
I know her, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Darcy Connor.
Oh. And
she is back in graduate school. So, but the point is that she developed this with the people at the city, and now they have it. It's in a form that's applicable to any town.
Okay.
And it could be in the city, in a coastal town or whatever. It's one of those where they made it so they can just hire somebody to do it and organize it.
I thought you were trying to get in touch with her.
Oh, no, I found her. I know. We wanted to clone her, but they wouldn't let us do that. And this, it goes on to talk about this, providing resources and encouragement for good neighbor efforts. I'm not going to read through every single thing here because it's going to take all the time. But a lot of these things, and I hope you will read through this, providing state support to local governments and private organizations for trainings in the areas of mental health and comfort care. Because federal funds do not cover staff time or costs of training. And that's going to be really important because people are going to be very upset by these things. And one of the things that we talked about, well, I'll go through this and talk about that later, investigate the feasibility of allowing citizens to possess larger supplies of prescription medications that will allow maintenance of their health while waiting for the transportation infrastructure to be reestablished. And that's one of the things that people don't understand. The roads to the coast are going to be gone. There's going to be no normal transportation happening. And we heard this from the OSU guys. And so we're going to be basically locked off. And if people need medication, diabetics, whatever, and mental health medication, they should be allowed to have it and have it in stock so they can use it as they need it, because that would just be another disaster on top. Supporting continuation of 911 service, and that which is scheduled to sunset in 2007. Support funding for a statewide interoperability communications network, and this is going to be crucial to keeping the state on track to recovery. Facilitate voluntary county participation in a reverse 911 system to foster statewide coverage. Support funding for earthquake monitoring station, light detection and range, which is LIDAR mapping of the landslide-prone areas, and nearshore ocean floor mapping. And I think this is really important because this will, and we saw the presentation on that the last time, and that the fact that the state has only 5% of the ocean floor mapped, it's impossible to predict what kind of, you know, path the wave would take unless we know what it's looking like down there. So consider whether it's appropriate to modify regulations for development in hazard zones. Provide the governor authority to require evacuations, institute quarantines, and cancel public events under specified disaster conditions. Direct Parks and Recreation Department to promulgate rules and develop plans to utilize state park and state fairground space for temporary shelter sites and to provide potable water where available, and to encourage local jurisdictions to do the same. We're all going to have to share. Consider using schools and other public buildings for temporary shelter. Support funding for implementation of the 2005 Legislative Action Senate Bills 2, 3, 4, and 5 related to the statewide earthquake hazard assessments. And this has already started with Department of DOGAMI, has started their assessment of buildings. And support Office of Emergency Management legislative concepts. Some might be duplicates, such as funding 911 systems, examining the governor's ability to implement mandatory evacuations and canceling public events, emergency command restructuring, rebuilding and replacing segments of the state communications infrastructure. And actions to support necessary steps during a disaster event. Improve disaster notification, provide prompt official notification, and broadcast a consistent and single message to state agencies, local jurisdictions, and citizens about detected natural disaster events that have affected or will likely to affect Oregon. Broadcast accurate and updated information to citizens regarding location and extent of disaster and recommended citizen action to avoid unnecessary panic, jamming communication lines to emergency responders, or overwhelming hospital services. And I have to tell you, I took my husband to the ER a month ago, and I had been reading a lot of this stuff in preparation for our next meeting, and this is the Seaside Hospital. It has 4 beds, and then there are 4 kind of sort of beds. So there's, at the most, there's 8 beds to put people in, and that's just so unbelievable. And they had 2 nurses and 1 doctor on staff at that time. No backup available. I know that for my sister's the one on-call person. She was out of town. And for the surgery team, there are 5 of them, and she's one of them. So, you know, and imagine without power, without all that, you know, it's we're not in real great shape. So if this happens, don't get hurt.
quick question, Representative. In that regard, say a significant event transpires on the coast and mm-hmm. so much of the transportation infrastructure is impassable or unusable. What about mobile MASH units? What have we identified as assets that from the National Guard or regular Army that can be integrated to help us?
We did talk about that, and what we are hoping that will happen in the process of this committee and recommendations is that all available, not just military, but local farmers, loggers, whatever, whoever has equipment, I mean, right down to a bulldozer if you need it to get through and load things in the bucket and run it through to get something from point A to point B. But that was discussed quite a bit, too, down at our subcommittee meeting in Cannon Beach. And all the local jurisdictions and special you know, fire districts and people like that are very willing, and they seem to know there's quite a network already of people who know who has what. The fact of the matter is we need to ask them to, somehow we have to catalog all that or whatever you do to, and
well, you just pointed out a significant problem, though, and at Seaside, mm-hmm. you don't have much in the way of a medical community to respond, at least in terms of a hospital and on-call individuals. Astoria is up the road. They obviously have more capability. But if your hospitals are unusable mm-hmm. because of a tsunami and people are in need, how do we get them assets to go on the ground with trained personnel to provide medical attention within 24 hours, 48 hours, 72? What?
Well, we talked about that, too. And we'll have the hospital's in good shape as far as where it's located.
Okay.
Getting to it's a problem. The bridges could all go out. The problem's personnel and equipment. It's small. That's the thing.
Okay.
The reality of this is that we're going to see local responding units, which are almost all volunteer, mm-hmm. they're going to be taking care of themselves first and their families. And there is, that was discussed too. And
right.
the chiefs say they'll go to the stations, but not in Seaside, not in Cannon Beach, not in Rockaway Beach. They're going to be headed for higher ground just like the rest of us. Mm-hmm. And what the plan is that to have, if you take a vehicle out, you take it out and put it on the other side or take it up so you'll have something. Mm-hmm. But nobody is going to be doing anything till it settles down a bit. And then they'll have to try to respond from that. And that's why in Seaside, they have, I think there are 12. Did you remember how many of those little garden shacks they're talking about? The stash?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like up in Alaska where they load up supplies, big group, bunch of it. They're putting these in people's yards and asking for them to agree to host them, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so they'll have some supplies up high and kind of maintain them, guard them. And they'll rotate supplies in and out of them, water or whatever's dated. But that's when you think of it and we think of how many people there, what if this happens during Hood to Coast or something? We've got 80,000 people there.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a real problem. Numbers of people that we can handle locally is bad enough. But so people need to be, I guess, informed, willing to, and ready to take care of themselves and their families, because that's what it's going to be. And then all the emergency responders, as they will respond if they want to, they're volunteers, but they're all going to be out, you know, firemen, they'll be out there. And they're going to be doing that almost as a second wave. So as far as medical stuff, it'll be whoever's trained will be working on the ground and doing whatever they can, I suppose.
What about identifying outside assets like Fort Lewis, Washington, the Army base?
We did talk about that.
There should be, and you've really, I think, hit the nail on the head of what the problem was at Katrina. Is, you know, there were firefighters and policemen wanting to go take care of their own families, mm-hmm. to get their own families to safety. So that begs the question then about what outside assets can you bring in that don't have those liabilities, mm-hmm. like National Guard units. We sent 2,000 mm-hmm. National Guard down there. What can we bring in from Washington, from Idaho, from California, in terms of National Guard or regular Army units to help us with this immediate problem? How fast can we get them there? How can we get them there? Do they have mobile surgical hospitals, teams? This has all got to be part of what we ultimately address as part of this plan.
We will be relying heavily on that exact thing.
We obviously have agreements in terms of National Guard, and General Caldwell can talk about that, between National Guard units. But what about regular Army units? And what about if we get a circumstance on the coast where the roads are impassable, you physically cannot drive relief supplies in there, then we're really relegated to air or sea lift. What are our capacities there beyond just National Guard units that we have available here, aircraft, regular Army,
private pilots,
private helicopter pilots. Mm-hmm. I mean, helicopters, I think, are probably going to be our most efficient form of transportation. This is all stuff that I mean, it's unique to you on the coast. Mm-hmm. Because you're going to be isolated in a way that the rest of the state wouldn't be by your geographic location. And how are we going to deal with that? And those are questions I think we have got
to
have answered in place.
Yeah, we actually brought those up and talked about that at length at that committee hearing. And Brian was there, and we were talking about that, and he said the same thing. Helicopters would be the one, you know. But he was talking about how many were there available? Only about four. Something like that. There were very few.
Six, although six. I understand that we've got more back from duty overseas.
Okay, well, let me just finish this really quick here.
Debbie, just a second,
sure.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Did you map on the coast where the National Guard is? Camp Rialea is going to get a wave curl over the top of it. They're gone. So you got no National Guard in Astoria. Clear down to wherever. Tell them the next National Guard, Newport, where is it?
Newport. Newport. The Armory.
Yeah, so.
Well, and Rialea's up a ways. Is how high? I don't know how high it is.
Yeah, it's very high.
It's not too high.
It's not very high.
No, it's got some berms in front of it. But
well, let's see if we can't interrogate.
We'll get him up there.
Come up a little later. All right, Debbie, go ahead.
That's
okay.
A good point.
And then these are the actions recommended to support post-disaster response and relief. Create a database with common language and compatible data formats of federal, state, local, faith-based, private, and volunteer organizations and resources. Search and rescue, medical, mental health, comfort care. So there you go. Shelter and financial resources easily accessible to local governments and state agencies. Inventory state, local, and privately owned equipment available for immediate deployment to affected areas for rescue efforts and reopening transportation efforts, infrastructure. Examine the need for additional air support, water, craft availability to move emergency response teams and supplies to affected areas when roads and bridges are impassable. And consider stocking body bags to supply affected areas in order to maintain sanitary conditions during the recovery. And so that addresses some of that, and we may not have hit all of them, but that's pretty, I think it's made a good good base for it. And
one of the things I noticed, Representative Boone, is that some of the other subcommittees, and I say this to those of you who are chairing other subcommittees, there are going to be some overlays here,
I was just going to hand you this one as ours. It's almost exactly.
There are going to be a number of overlays, and so I think as the full committee, it will be our challenge to decide whether where four subcommittees all prioritize these things and lift them up, how we treat the final report, and so be thinking about that. This was a good report. And even though there are some things that are being discussed in each situation, there are other things that are being discussed that are not the same. And so I think it will all play out very, very well.
Madam Chair,
are there other questions?
Yeah.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
First off, I want to apologize to Representative Boone for missing the sub-meeting, but sometimes farming gets in the way of other things.
I understand.
It's just one of those things.
You just have to bring me some characters.
You know, okay, I will. And I'm here today because it's raining. So the one point on providing the governor authority, governor's got a lot of authority currently in disasters, but there's kind of an over... maybe a more global thing than just this, and that is defining authority of local public health officials. Because number one, the people on the ground are the ones that are going to have a better idea of what's needed. And we've been looking at this in just for epidemic, pandemic sort of thing, statewide, not just in case of tsunami, but what sort of authorities we need to give the local jurisdictions to deal with these things. So I think when we're looking at the authority to deal with emergencies. We'd be short-sighted if we were just looking at the governor's office, not looking at county health officials and people like that, because truly they're the ones that are really going to be in place to know what needs to be done. And so a lot of authority needs to rest at that level. You know, especially a lot of the coast, it's going to be isolated. You know, the governor can declare an emergency, but he's not in Brookings.
Right.
So,
right. I really appreciate those comments and that question. And I'm going to ask Senator George if he wouldn't respond a little bit, since he's just chaired a meeting this morning that discussion.
Well, absolutely. And it was really amazing. Members of my committee this morning were looking at this list saying, we must have looked at this before we went in there, because we followed almost exactly the same question. But there is one question that we just talked about a few minutes ago, and it was, Debbie, when you were talking about the situation of being a shortage of doctors and, mm-hmm. you know, first responders. Does our Good Samaritan law cover broadly enough to allow the veterinarian or the person who's maybe had previous medical treatment for them to have a shield from liability in an emergency? Do we know the answer to that question? That was a question we were...
No, thinking. That is a good question, and I don't know. I can't remember if we've discussed that or not, but didn't we discuss all the different permutations of medical people that we might draw upon?
But see, this gets back to the who's in charge thing. I think they do have liability protection if the executive branch mm-hmm. is in charge, but if you know, if we're looking at how we deal with what's on site, to give the local health department or the county health officer the ability to recruit and what assets they have, we may need to look at some liability protection on that level, too.
I'd like to recognize Senator Carter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, those are some of the issues that we discussed this morning, because as I visited Louisiana and as I worked with, and then Tom, I'm sure, is going to talk about some of this when he comes up from the state, but jurisdictional issues are so important that those issues must be dealt with prior to any event that takes place catastrophically in our state.
Absolutely.
And so as we prepared a report back to the President and the Senate, President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House, and recommendations to the Governor's Office, it should be that in the case of an emergency, jurisdictional issues are superseded by whomever is in charge, and more than likely, if it's at the state, it will be the governor that is in charge. And so those issues, in case of any kind of catastrophic event, should be dealt with before time, because I thought, and you know who is the great big gorilla standing in the way, are us as politicians. The local people didn't have any problem getting together to get things done, mm-hmm. but the governor and the mayor were concerned about who's in charge. Or the certain local officials were saying, well, not in my county or not in my city. And that's why it's important that we get these things done now while there's calmness and there is a more rational belief system, I believe, to deal with this kind of stuff so that we will know who's in charge. And I tell you, we have a wonderful person at the state, and when he comes up, you'll hear him, because we've already worked some of this stuff as well. So Tom will be here to talk about it.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Gardley?
Thank you very much. I'm really appreciating what Senator Carter has shared, and I just want to point out to our committee members, I've brought for you today an article from the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies. The article is titled, A Wake-Up Call for Local Elected Officials, Are We Really Prepared for Local Disasters? The article draws on some of the lessons learned from Katrina, but also lessons learned through a national study titled Redefining Readiness, that looked at emergency planning through the eyes of the public. The article makes the point that often planners are planning in planning land, but they're not necessarily thinking out of the box and including local community voices and others who can help shape the who could help identify the needs and shape the strategy. So I just make this article available to you. I also have a question, though, about the recommendations coming from the subcommittee. It isn't clear to me who would be responsible for implementation of some of these actions and who would have oversight over making sure that the actions being recommended get done.
Some of these, you know, they're divided into before, during, and after. And before is preparatory, and that's prevention or being as prepared as you can. During, it's going to be absolute chaos. It's just, seriously, that's just how things go. After, I think it's going to be, and what Senator Cruz has suggested, giving locals, jurisdictions, and authorities the authority to do what needs to be done because they're familiar with their area and they know what it is needs to be done. In a case, for example, on our fire department, if there's an accident on the highway and it's a state highway and there's a situation where we need to stop traffic, the fire chief can do it, basically go over state police, and state police come and they are very cooperative and they will end up doing traffic so we can do what we need to do. And you can do that. And it's if you have a problem, like there's a doctor or nurse or some medical person in the pileup of cars.
I didn't ask the question well enough. Let me give you an example. On the last page, the action to support post-disaster response and relief, create a database with common language, et cetera. Who would be responsible for doing that, and who would make sure that got done? That's what I'm after.
Something we'll have to make sure to keep in mind.
Yeah, I think, are you talking about the chain of command thing, the structure chain of command?
Mm-hmm. No, I'm asking about creating a database with common language, compatible data formats. Is that the Office of Emergency Management? Is that the thinking that they would be responsible for doing?
I don't think we identified who would do that, but I think that what we were talking about is having it available, so I suppose it'd be a group effort from local on up to have it available statewide, so we would know, you could get in and find out who's available for, say you needed counselors, mental health counselors, or you need more, you know, like Representative Krupp was saying, you need more medical personnel or supplies or something like that, so it's there. And in the case of the disaster, you could, whoever is the keeper of this database would be able to disseminate that in a fashion that would be, you know, we talked about different computer systems using different languages and that we need to be all on the same page that way so that you can send it that way.
See, Madam Chair, that makes my point. That exactly makes my point, because Senator Gordon would know, right now, if anything would happen, it would appear to me that the emergency preparedness group at the state would immediately be in charge. That's what I would think. But that's not necessarily true. No. When we were doing the Katrina thing in Portland area, we had to get in a room. Tell me, it must have took us 2 hours to even get different people to decide who's going to let anybody do what. We would be in more of a mess as well, because we don't know who's in charge of what. And so it appeared to me that we need some kind of legislation and talking to all the different jurisdictions about who's going to be in charge.
Well, Senator Carter, I think that if you talk to people who are mayors of cities, they would tell you that they are in charge.
Absolutely.
And that at the point of time that they feel they cannot handle their city, they will call the county, but only at their discretion. And then when the county comes in, when they feel they cannot handle it, they then will add their little bit to the state. So I think you're in some camps, you're third in line. So I think that's it. Senator Marcet.
Well, we should ask Ken Murphy. He would probably be able to answer that question. Secondly, Lane County has an emergency management team, and I think they are pretty well together on emergency management for a variety of issues. I guess what I want to know, what I think is lacking, is the worst case scenario, because, you know, if we have a 9.2 off the coast, there's going to be buildings collapsing in Salem, bridges collapsing in Portland, there's going to be total chaos. If the earth indeed does drop, which is the first time I ever heard that was last meeting, then that changes what people are supposed to do. I mean, if you're standing on the beach and the ground starts shaking, you have to know that maybe the earth is going to drop if you don't get out of there, you know, and don't wait until the ground stops. I mean, there are just a lot of things we don't know. I would like to have some kind of a worst-case scenario from geologists that could help us understand how we prepare for this, because the governor may be busy. He may be in this building digging himself out of herself out of the pile. It could devastate the valley. It could destroy roads to the coast. And we don't know that yet. We're still thinking about the big wave after 20 minutes. There's more to it than that. So I think we need to go back to the geologists and have them come up and agree on the worst case scenario. 9.2, totally different picture. And then we, you know, and I'm okay, and I guess the answer to the part of the question, I think that Ken Murphy probably has some answers to who's in charge. Don't you, Ken? Yeah, okay. So instead of us trying to figure that out, we should ask them first and then see if we need to make changes.
All right, Senator Cruz?
Yeah, well, looking forward to the 9-2, I'll have oceanfront property. But which might be worth more than riverfront, you never know. I think Senator Carter makes a really great point here. And when you bounce that off of what Senator Verger said, what we don't have, I mean, because clearly the mayor thinks they're in charge and county commissioners think they're in charge and state thinks they're in charge. And I think if we come up with anything out of this committee is a defined chain of command. If we have that, so that the mayor knows, so that the county commissioner knows responsibilities and where things have to go. I mean, if we're going to do anything really productive, we can't plan for a 9-2, but we can plan a chain of command. So I think if we can come up with that, so that duties and responsibilities are clearly defined under different scenarios, I think we'll have done something monumental.
I'll just point out the second item on the right. Pre-disaster prep was to do that, just that. So.
Well, I understand that. I just re-emphasizing the point because, you know, what Senator Verger said was exactly the way it works. You know, if we have a flood, you know, I'm in charge of my farm, and, you know, until it gets so bad, then I'm going to go ask somebody else to help. I mean, it's that sort of thing. So, but we can't have 100 chiefs and no Indians in this thing. We got to have chain of command here.
Well, this discussion is a good one to lead in to the second thing on our agenda. And so we're now going to look at the emergency command structure proposal. And I will ask those of you who are going to make the presentation to come forward.
Oh, here. Now we're going to get the answers.
The three musketeers.
And they're smiling.
I'll ask that you introduce yourselves for the record and continue with the presentation in the order in which you should so choose.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here from the Victory Group, Inc., representing the Oregon Military Department as a consultant on transitioning Homeland Security to the Military Department.
Madam Chair, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell with the Oregon National Guard. I'm the Deputy Director.
Madam Chair, my name is Ken Murphy. I'm the Director of Oregon Emergency Management.
I'm so glad it's not Tom. Madam Chair, I was calling him Tom.
I know what you meant, Senator.
Madam Chair, I'll go ahead and start off today. We're here to talk to you about some recommendations that the governor has asked us to bring before you so that you can be included in an ongoing discussion about where the best place for Homeland Security and emergency response to be housed within the state. He's asked to do that in the understanding that this is the type of issue that is non-jurisdictional. It doesn't matter whether you're state, you're local, you're federal. It doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat, House, Senate, or governor. This is an issue that all of us are going to have to grapple with the goal of making sure that the Oregon system responding to any emergency, no matter who is in charge, is as well-oiled a machine as possible, because the time to set that system up is not when the disaster is upon you. The governor is has asked us to talk to you about this today because of the timing of this issue. He does want to present to you, through us today, the concept of moving Homeland Security and Emergency Management under the Oregon Military Department. However, the timeline is really much more flexible. He would like to look, obviously, at the idea of introducing legislation for next session to solidify whatever might be able to be done during the interim, but we want to have a long and thorough discussion with you about how that form needs to take place so that we don't make any mistakes along the way and so that we have the benefit of this group's knowledge that you've gained through your experience in having people come to testify before you and through your subcommittee work, because as you have seen, the types of disasters and issues that can come before a state are extremely varied, and as a result, there's no easy one-fix system. What we're going to talk to you about today is, first of all, why the move to the military is a good one, and then we're going to talk to you about some of the details of what we've been looking at as options. One thing I do want to identify right off the bat, mostly because you're going to be having a presentation later about wireless interoperability. You'll note in the document that you were presented, the verbiage document at the end, there's a supplemental recommendation of having the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network move to the military department. In subsequent discussions with the people who really have a great deal of expertise around that area and the amount of work that's going to take, the recommendation will not be to put that portion under the military department. Very likely, state police is the most likely location for that. Obviously, that's a discussion that the people who will be coming up after that will want to have with you in more depth, to the extent that they think it's necessary to address that sort of structural issue. Obviously, to my right and to my left, you have two experts, both in the way that the military has been able to respond to emergency and more recently in military activities throughout the world. And on my left, of course, you have an expert in emergency response, both of whom have a great amount of knowledge and experience that they can convey to you in the discussion of moving Homeland Security and emergency response under the military department. With that, we'll be going through a couple of set issues, and then after they're done discussing the whys, then I'll take you through some of the discussions about the structural changes that would need to take place in order to move Homeland Security and emergency response under the military department. And I might interject on a couple of occasions about observations I've been able to have over the last couple of years in dealing with both of these organizations in both emergency response and Homeland Security. So, Mike, do you want to talk a little bit about what the structure has been in other states?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think as we've looked at other states and we've seen a variety of different structures that both have the emergency management function in the military departments and those that don't, and it changes. I think it has a lot to do with respect to events that occur in particular notions of different people, but right now I think the number was 21 or 22 states have that function. National Guard has that function inside those states. I think an argument can be made for both. You can argue, one, that it's good, and two, that it isn't. And I think as we progress through what we've seen since 9/11, I think the inclination is going to be more for the states to go this direction. As we look at both what happened in 9/11 and also what we saw in Katrina with respect to the federal support that comes in, it generally is going to come in the support of the military. The federal military is the best organized, probably has the most resources, and can move massive amounts of equipment and materiel on a fairly robust fashion, more so than than a civilian agency is designed to do. This is how they're designed. This is what they're prepared to do, to go any place in the world to do this. So I think it makes logical sense that they would be the right organization to have that tasking. I think where the advantage comes for Oregon or any other state that has this is at some point in a major disaster, whether it be an event off the coast of Oregon or a Katrina event like we saw in the Gulf states last September, what you end up seeing is the local authorities, both state and local governments, are overwhelmed. And this is exactly what happened in Katrina, is that they could no longer render support to their citizens, the state government and the National Guard, because they were busy fighting for their own lives, literally trying to stay alive. So at that time, and I think if there was any probably in the after action reviews we've seen, if any criticism is due, it was that they didn't pull the trigger quick enough to ask for federal help. And once that federal help trigger was pulled, then it became massive influx of all federal help that was available to FEMA, but mainly the military, because they are designed to move quickly and with lots of equipment and lots of logistic support and people. And they can do that rather rapidly. They have the equipment, they have the know-how, the training, and the skill. In our case, I think it makes logical sense for us because we have a portal to that. We are both a state force under the command of the governor until such time that we're mobilized by the president, as you've seen in this state for operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. But we have a natural relationship with both the Army and the Air Force. Now, not so much with the Navy, but we do have a joint operating agreements or joint commands, basically, at Northern Command, where General Reese just came from, where you do have the Navy in charge of that one, actually. So you have this interagency or intermilitary joint operations environment. So I think it's something that from our standpoint, we believe that it'll work quite well because we're used to that joint operating environment. We're used to working with the Air Force, the Army, the Marine Corps. And you got to have assets. You got to identify the problem, and then you got to be able to get to those assets as quickly as possible. And we already have that connection made. We don't have to go reinvent it. We don't have to learn new lingo. We don't have to learn new faces or new command structures. It's already there. We're already accustomed to it because we deal with it every day. So in that respect, I think at the point where you have to go outside your state, which is probably in this instance, we didn't see much of this in our 96 floods, but we did have to go outside the state to pick up, different products. One was sandbags. I don't know if you recall this or not, but in the middle of the night, we were flying sandbags in from California, and the Air Force and the Air Guard out of California were flying them in with C-130s. Delivering them to Portland, we were picking them up on CH-47 helicopters and taking them to Tillamook. So this was all happened simultaneously because we could react quickly inside of that chain or inside that environment. So I think in that respect alone, just from the localized emergency, probably not. It's not necessary and probably wouldn't be a requirement. But once that becomes more than just one local emergency in one county, as we saw in 96 in Oregon, where it spread throughout the Willamette Valley and on the coast, and we had inundated, I think, 17, 18 counties that were having great difficulty, it became necessary for us to go out and get other resources. And here again, I think it's in these instances, and we saw in Katrina, the speed is absolutely of the essence. If you don't have that speed, people suffer, people die. So that was why one of the great reasons I believe that we should
move. Caldwell, would you clarify exactly who is in the Oregon Military Department?
Madam Chairman, we have both an Army National Guard headquarters and a Army Guard headquarters inside the joint headquarters here in the military department. The Army National Guard in Oregon has 38 armories scattered throughout the state. We have 6,150 personnel, less about 1,000 of them that are deployed right now. And the Air National Guard has our air bases at Portland Air National Guard Base and also Kingsley Field, and also at Camp Rylea we have a unit of the Air Guard there. In the Air Guard, we have 2,100 people. So as far as assets go, we have everything from engineering to electronics to carpentry, plumbers, medical folks, infantry, armor, aviation, just to name ones off the top of my head. So we have a pretty large array. We've tried to structure the Oregon National Guard over the last 15 years to get segments of different components that are available to the Guard to fill those bills, not only for the active duties needs, because they need these, but we've sought out and received different units that come to Oregon so we can better serve the people of Oregon during an emergency, i.e. military police company. 15 years ago, we didn't have a military police company. We had one squad of military police embedded in a headquarters. Now we have a full-size company. 15 years ago, we didn't have heavy-lift helicopters. We do now. They're in Pendleton. And it was reported earlier that we were down to, I think, three or four. Actually, we have two available right now out of it, and they just got back from Afghanistan. They're going through some rebuilding and reprocessing, and we will have five hopefully available by the end of the summer or sometime in the fall. So those assets, we've sought those assets based on not only is it good for our people to have a variety of activities to aspire to do, but also those assets help us in our emergency response and need here in the state of Oregon. To give you an example.
I'd like to just follow up a minute with that and ask you, you know, people join the National Guard to help their neighbor. I mean, there are a lot of different reasons, but now you're going to Afghanistan and Iraq, and now you're going to protect the borders of the United States. And if we have a tsunami and an earthquake, are you worried that the Oregon Military Department would be depleted enough that we would be not having a full force to protect us?
Madam Chair, I think we always have a concern that when you have major deployments that you draw down your available resources. That's a natural concern. But I can assure you right now, out of the 8,200 members of the Oregon National Guard, roughly 1,000 of that 8,200 are deployed. So you've got roughly 7,000 people that are available to help to do exactly that. The big issue that we've been struggling with since the deployments began in Afghanistan and Iraq is the equipment issues. We've talked to our congressional delegation. Congress is moving forward to try to replenish the equipment because much of our equipment went but didn't come home. And we are very much in need of certain items, trucks, for example. We were short somewhere in the neighborhood of 150 different kinds and sizes, shapes of trucks. So those are concerns. But I think if you look at the National Guard system and you look at how the Guard is developed over the years, what we have is we're a reserve component to both the Army and the Air Force. So we have a federal mission that we have to train for, which is what benefits the state most always is that we have a lot of equipment, a lot of personnel who are trained and paid for by the federal government. 97% of, or actually 98% of our budget is federal. And that equipment and those personnel can transition very rapidly and very readily to a need at the local level. The state of Oregon, frankly, couldn't afford the Oregon National Guard if we had it in the context we have it today. I mean, we think we got budget problems. We would break the state budget. So there is a quid pro quo when you take these assets and you take these to use it during an emergency, then, of course, they need to be available to the national authorities so they can go out and do what they were trained to do, which is augment and supplement the active component in time of war, and that's what we're doing now.
Two things. Do I owe you an apology? Have I given you the wrong rank?
Yes, ma'am.
My apologies, General Caldwell.
You don't owe me an apology, but you did get the wrong one.
Well, I am happy to promote you right away. My last question to you is, how do you think it's going to affect your recruiting? Because if I thought I was going to join the National Guard to go on maneuvers and to help my neighbor, and now you tell me I'm going to go to Iraq, I might have a little bit of a chill on my decision to sign the paper. So how do you think that's going to affect the future? Because we may have this major disaster in 3 or 4 years, and not now.
Madam Chair, I think, you know, it's always been a mystery to me, and I've only been doing this now for 35, going on 36 years. If we're recruiting well, our recruiters say it's the economy. If we're not doing well and you ask recruiters what the problem is, it's the economy. So, and of course the old adage, you know, recruiters only lie when their lips move. So, you know, it's one of those deals where you never, it's a hard thing to quantify, and I must be completely candid. Right now our recruiting levels are up. Now, they took a dip. There's no question about that. About a year and a half ago, we were probably as low as we'd been in 15, 20 years as far as new recruits go. I can assure you right now that I can't imagine that we could find out of that 8,200 people that I could find one person that said, nobody told me about I might have to go to war if I joined the National Guard. either the person was not listening and chose not to listen, because everything we do, every bit of training we do, is done at the same pace, same level, and the same conscripts of the active component. We don't go to different schools. We don't send people to different basic training sites. They all go to the same school, active and guard. They're mixed in the same. They don't segregate them. If you look at a platoon of basic trainees or advanced individual training classes, and you look at them, you can't tell one from the other. They're all the same. At the end of the training, some of them will pack up and come home to the guard. Some of them will go on to an active duty station. So anybody that's in the National Guard today fully knows that the expectation is that their primary mission is to be a reserve component for the active component, and that mission is to go out and prosecute a war and win it. So I can't imagine somebody not knowing that.
Well, I thank you for answering my questions, and proceed with your presentation, and then I'll have it open for questions after all of you are finished.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just wanted to add perspective, since Oregon Emergency Management is a subject here being moved, and I do think I have some qualifications. I spent 29 years in the National Guard here in Oregon, so I do understand it, and am very proud of what I achieved. And I think this is a, when you look at command structures and how organizations work, and I think this lends itself to somewhat what Senator Carter was leading up to, that I think it is a good match and a complementary structure to move emergency management and the Oregon Military Department together. The current National Incident Management System that was instituted here a few years ago by the Department of Homeland Security is something that was sorely needed. It did talk about common language. It did talk about command structures. And I think one thing that complements it, when you put it side by side to a military command structure, there's many similarities. And I think the important thing is that how emergency management is being shaped across our nation today because of all the recent events over the last 5 or 6 years complements being together with the Oregon National Guard. We are co-located now. We recently worked together during Hurricane Katrina evacuees both in the Portland area and sending troops to Louisiana. It worked perfectly, very smoothly. And so I think our systems and our structures are very complementary of each other, and it's a very good transition. The language is identical in most cases, other than they have rank and we wear suits, small anomalies like that. And I think our ability to work together has been proven many times, and working together, we can address those issues that you've brought here, because I think there will always be times, whether it's war or whatever the case may be, that the Guard may be someplace else, protecting our country or our state. And part of what I bring to the military department, too, that we work together, is I have equally robust systems of national mutual aid, partnerships with Canada, in-place contracts with numerous businesses and organizations to bring to bear the things that we need that potentially the Guard may not be able to have, or if nothing else, supplement what they have. So I think what we work towards, and when you think about what the National Guard trains for in preparation for war, if you take away the rifle and the enemy and put out there an earthquake or a flood, you're really training towards the same thing. It's about achieving a goal to protect people's lives and save our property. So I think it's very complementary, and I think the structures will help each other improve and mature, and will give us the tools to do, as Senator Cruz talked about, and Senator Carter, we need to do all this now before the disaster happens. Too many times, and I know everyone on the committee has seen this, this nation reacts after the disaster, and I would like the state of Oregon to react before the disaster.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before I talk to you a little bit about the elements that we've discussed as being potential for transfer, I want to take the opportunity to share with you a little bit about how well these two organizations have been able to work together, and I'll use Katrina as an example because that was one I was able to see firsthand. And Madam Chair, I know both Senator Carter and Senator Gurley were involved in some of our phone calls that we had with the local level when we were dealing with the evacuees. We had both the Emergency Operations Center, which is the emergency management side of the house, and the Joint Emergency Operations Center, which is the military side of the house, operating two doors away from each other within the same structure. They had people going back and forth throughout this period of time, and if you remember, this was over a three-day weekend when the military was in the process of mobilizing 2,100 soldiers to go down. They provided the biggest footprint of any assistance in the hurricane response. One of the things you may not know is when those 2,100 people arrived there, they had shelter, they had transportation, they had communication, and they had everything they needed to do the job. Not everyone provided that, and those who came without those things became a burden until that could be straightened out. That was not the situation with our folks. They got on the ground, and as a result of their work, they were put in command of Task Force Katrina that was ready to respond when the next hurricane hit. At the same time, our emergency management folks were working to try to prepare for evacuees that were coming in from the region at a time when, on a daily basis and often an hourly basis, we were getting conflicting information about whether we would have evacuees, how many evacuees, how would they be transported, until ultimately the jurisdictions in the state of Oregon stopped listening to FEMA, and they would wait until our folks at emergency management gave them the word because it was too confusing otherwise. So these two groups work very, very well together. Now, granted, should it occur that there is a disaster in the state of Oregon, that changes the dynamic because it's happening here and it's much more difficult. But both of these organizations operated with such professionalism and such attention to task that I think we're going to be well served by them. The only way we could be better served by them is if they're operating in the same structure. They do work very well together, but the fact that they have to have two different cards to go back and forth to one another is something that probably could help them working together. What I'd like to point out to you, you have, aside from the packet of information you were provided, is a single sheet. It's a little easier to understand than some of the stuff that was provided in your initial packet that talks about what the potential for transition would be. On May 11th, 2004, when the governor created the Office of Homeland Security, we combined four different elements in that office. So those were Oregon Emergency Management, the Criminal Justice Services Division, the State Fire Marshal's Office, and the Office of Public Safety and Security. Obviously, there was a bill during last session that the legislature did not adopt that would have created a separate statutory standalone agency. One of the things that you may not know is emergency management and their staff over the last several years have been in an on-again, off-again pattern of whether they were a standalone agency under state police, whether they were given authority to act independently or not. After a while, that wears on morale and their ability to respond effectively, and so what we're trying to do is find them a permanent home that they can finally have some stability. We prefer that the instability that they deal with occurs during a disaster, not in their daily work life. So that is a large part of why we're trying to bring these two organizations together and find some stability. Part of what we would do is transition over, for the most part, the entirety of Oregon Emergency Management. Again, there are going to be some issues about whether elements of that would be going to the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network, and those discussions will continue. The other part of that is the Criminal Justice Services Division. They're the organization that currently handles all of our Homeland Security grant processing. They have some other grants that they deal with as well. They're primarily dealing with law enforcement issues and aren't really a good fit with the Homeland Security Emergency Management side of the house, and so we are talking about the idea of breaking them off, perhaps putting the Violence Against Women Act in the Department of Justice, where they're currently most of their funding is going to programs in that agency anyway, the rest of them perhaps going to the Criminal Justice Commission, which currently is running some grants that the legislature gave them during the last legislative session around drug courts. They also are the one entity in the state that deals with policy around law enforcement and public safety issues, so there's a good fit there as well. The rest of it, the Homeland Security portion, would transition over to the Homeland Security and Emergency Management section of what would then be in the military department. The State Fire Marshal's Office, largely because of a tremendous amount of their responsibility, fits very well with the law enforcement efforts in state police, would go back to state police. arson investigations and things along those lines are a good fit there. Those folks are very happy with the idea of going back to state police, and so that seemed to be a good fit. And then finally, the Office of Public Safety and Security was never really an ingrained part of the Office of Homeland Security. It would have been by interagency agreement, but of course, the Office of Homeland Security as an executive order never fully became separate from the state police, and as a result, there really was no need for an interagency agreement. If that becomes necessary in the future, then it's very easy for the state police superintendent and the adjutant general of the state of Oregon to enter into an interagency agreement to keep that relationship going. It's a fairly simple process. The main question is timing. Whether or not this is something that can be done during the interim to facilitate legislation during the next legislative session, or whether or not this needs to wait until there is the legislation in place, we don't know yet, and we're looking forward to your input in that area. But this is the structure that we would put forward as a recommendation as being probably the easiest to implement, the one that accomplishes the ultimate mission of both emergency management and the military department jointly. And one that's gone through quite a bit of internal discussion, but has not yet had the opportunity to be provided to you for discussion with you. So with that, we're open for any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. You're very excellent communicator, very clear. All right, Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions. After Hurricane Katrina specifically, there was some criticism directed at the bureaucracy of Homeland Security overseeing FEMA and the ability of FEMA to move things up and down the chain of command for timely response to certain elements of Hurricane Katrina. Anecdotally, I was on the ground with some Border Patrol guys in Arizona recently, and a common complaint I heard from them was now that they've been integrated into Homeland Security, they have another layer of bureaucracy that they have to work through that creates, I guess, a morale problem, for lack of a better word, because they can't get things done in a timely manner. Are we going to make the same mistake with doing this? And I'm going to open that up, and I'm going to direct that first to you, Ken. What's different about your ability to respond if you're under the military department compared to where you are today? Will it be inhibited? Will it be enhanced?
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, I don't think it will be inhibited. General Caldwell and General Reese and I have had some discussions, and in all honesty, I don't see a problem, and it really you could almost put us in any agency to some extent, as long as there's a clear delineation of when a disaster happens or response, recovery, mitigation, any phase of emergency management, that there's a clear line that when I need to talk to the governor, I need to talk to the governor. And I've had that discussion with the military department, and I don't see a problem. The military understands the chain of command very well, and I think they're more than willing to be able to deal in that atmosphere and understand that there still has to be a single point of contact, to make things happen during any type of a disaster situation. And I don't think that problem will exist. And I have been, if you get buried in an organization and you don't have the ability to communicate and access to the governor's staff when you need it, it cripples you, and you can't accomplish certain things. And even when there's not a disaster, you still have to have that support, public education and outreach. Very important, probably more important than being ready for the disaster is teaching people about the things before the disaster. So I made those comments to the military department that, I would hope and, surely desire that General Reese and however it does come out structure-wise, that there's a clear message that this is important to them as an agency, and that they're just as interested in preparing the citizens of Oregon for emergency preparedness and being ready.
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, I would concur with Ken. I think that I guess from a realistic standpoint, having the pleasure of having been a county commissioner, and also a city councilman, I can and gone through a couple of disasters. And also being in the Guard, I think, you know, the one thing that, that Representative Boone, I think, was bringing out earlier in your discussion, what part I got, was these are absolutely inherently, these are local issues. The local government is the one who has to deal with the issue first and foremost. In the event that the local government can't, then they need a very rapid response from the state government. And vis-a-vis, the same goes to the feds. I think Ken's establishment in 36 counties, he has emergency managers, he's got good relationships. We have armories in not all 36 counties, but in 28 of them, I think, 28, 29 of the counties have armories in them. I think it strengthens his network, frankly. I think it actually strengthens the emergency management network as opposed to any degradation of it. His comment about chain of command, we're very tuned to that. We understand that very, very well. And we understand how that works, and we understand that the governor, as the general does quite often, can go anywhere in the chain of command, pick up the person and call them and talk to them, and they're supposed to respond. I think that's the most important aspect of this, is communication between the governor and Ken, or the manager on the ground. But more importantly, it's the local government, how they access that resource. Because that's what they're looking for when they call. They need resourcing. They need something, or they don't have to call. They can handle that emergency. And they're not going to call unless they need it. And I think that's where we're working together through the years, and also with our network of established units and chains of command, that's going to work as well or better than it has in the past.
Madam Chair, one comment and then the last question for General Caldwell. Yesterday I had the privilege of meeting and having breakfast with General Honore down when I was... privileged to be with the governor and congressman the following year to say goodbye to 900 Oregon National Guardsmen, 41st Brigade down in Camp Shelby, Mississippi. And I got to tell you, his example, I think he's been widely credited that once the responsibility was given to him to work with our units and others, that things happened much more efficiently at on the ground level there in Louisiana with the response to Hurricane Katrina. And I think it's probably one of the things that gives me the most confidence that this is the right direction to go in. But I have to tell you, yesterday he was very effusive in his praise of the Oregon National Guard for coming down and having helped. Was very appreciative of that. And it's pretty obvious that what you just stated is that we had units ready to go with all of their supporting equipment and needs taken care of when we arrived in the state of Louisiana, that made us a much more effective unit from coming from the outside. And that sort of brings me back to my comments with you about what outside assets, because that's what we will need here. And that's what we're going to rely on you guys to do in your various roles, to have those agreements all set and ready to go. Two questions come to my mind. Secondly, there's a very small group of people, but yet qualified, that can help us with air assets. They have two aircraft based here in Oregon that are paid for by the U.S. Air Force, and that is Civil Air Patrol, which is an auxiliary arm of the U.S. Air Force. What plans do you have, or have you already integrated them into any of your emergency planning for a major catastrophic event? And then secondly, General Caldwell, specifically to you, how does this new structure affect the concept of reinvigorating the State Defense Force to be that part of the liaison between the military department and your local county emergency manager, this group of qualified ex-military officers and enlisted that want to be helpful, that will volunteer to do this. How does this affect that direction? Does it change it in any way? Is it still something that we need to do? Where are we at? So if you can answer those two questions for me, I'd appreciate it.
Now, Mr. Chairman, Representative Krupp, with respect to the State Defense Force, we just had a meeting this last weekend where we brought them together. I brought them together. And we have, in fact, laid out the design of exactly what you're talking about. For those of you that don't know, the State Defense Force is part of the Oregon National Guard in the statutory language. It's all volunteers. It consists of around 250 volunteers right now. And they have had their, I guess, differences with respect to what they do or don't do. One of the things that we got our arms around and said we're going to manage this regardless of this system changes what we're presenting today or not, these folks will be established in every county. We will do it by our battalions. We're already set up throughout the state. But in every county, there will be a member of the Oregon State Defense Force who is a known quantity, somebody who stays there, who's not going to be moved in and moved out based on rank structure and need to be promoted and any other thing that comes up with respect to our typical National Guardsmen. These folks will be there, they will be that liaison, and they will be in that county emergency operations center. That framework, as I said, just released this last week. We're starting to fill it as we speak, and we're going to start the training of those folks and working with the county emergency managers. So they've got a named face sitting in their EOC anytime they need it, so they can look at that person and say, I need X. Now, there's still not going to be this is not going to be a shortcut to the established system, but it will reduce time frames is what we're looking for. So when the county asks for something that they don't have, due to whatever circumstance they're facing, we can start the thing through two chains. One, right back through the National Guard. Two, right up through the emergency management. So they should meet. So we can get a head start on delivering that needed item. That's the whole objective here. And also to have communication when that item gets on the ground or those soldiers get on the ground or those assets get there, that we got direct communication back to the user, the person that's doing that work on the ground. So we don't have to run, the county doesn't have to go clear up to the military department, clear back down our chain of command. This short circuits that, gives them direct capability, direct linkage, and so we should reduce, which is mainly the big problem in any emergency, is you don't know what you don't know.
Right.
And information is the absolute premium item that you've got to have, and you've got to have good information to even make good decisions at that local level. So this will hopefully give them that capability. So it's in play. Like I said, Saturday, we laid it out, put it out. I suspect in
nothing
October,
changes here, General, with this arrangement.
Nothing, with or without it, nothing would change. As far as the Civil Air Patrol goes, we do have a liaison with the Civil Air Patrol. We liaison with them quite frequently, all the time, as a matter of fact, because we do business with them through the Air National Guard. Now, Kim's probably better able to answer the direct relationship with them and emergency management planning because we've not been involved with them in that respect.
I want to give everybody a chance to ask questions. I'm going to go to Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is interesting. You know, part of this whole chain of command thing, Cynthia, we keep bringing up Katrina, but the fact is that when Katrina happened, local officials didn't pull the trigger on assets they had in play. The state didn't pull the trigger on assets they had in play. And neither did the feds. But I will say that the one entity that responded and responded quickly and well was military, because they didn't have to go through all the bureaucratic crap everybody else did. Orders were given, orders were followed. You know, so there's some comfort in this. I've got a few questions about, which we can deal with later, about how much of the fire marshal's office is transferred and where, that sort of thing. But on this sheet, the one thing I don't see is the footprint of the federal government. And that's a huge concern. And once again, I'll bring up Katrina, where we had firefighters that went to Louisiana to help and ended up having to go through 2 days of sexual harassment training before they could go save lives because it was a federal requirement. And, you know, that sort of stuff frustrated them. It frustrated everybody and gives us all a black eye as government that we would do such stupid things. And I'm blaming the feds for that, okay? Nobody in this room. But I don't see the footprint of the federal government here. And where is it?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, the good news or the bad news is the federal government is always with us, whatever structure we have.
That's why I'm asking where the footprint is, because I know they are.
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, and perhaps Ken can describe this a little bit better, but a lot of the work that is currently being done by Oregon Emergency Management and the Office of Homeland Security is actually being directed by the federal government. There's a lot of planning, a lot of work that needs to be done. They don't provide staff to do that work. So in that sense, wherever we put Oregon Emergency Management, that is going to continue to be in place. There are no federal folks that are attached to either of these organizations that sit within this structure. This is state only, which is why you don't see a federal footprint there.
I understand that.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. But you get back to Senator Moore since 9-2, and guess what? The feds are going to be here. And so the question is, what are we doing at this point in time to convince them that, yes, we want your assets, but keep your damn bureaucracy to yourself?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, I think one aspect that's probably a very little known aspect is that we have inside of our headquarters a federal Title 10 officer, active duty Army officer, that does not work for us, but he's there. 365 days a year, he belongs to the Oregon National Guard. And one of his functions is to do that interplay between us and the active duty Army. We have the same at the air base with our Air National Guard. So we have that linkage in our hip pocket every single day of the year that we have this individual. And in the situation that you just described where military needs to be, we don't have the assets.
Right.
Washington doesn't have them. Idaho doesn't have them. The separate guard states around that we have agreements with under the EMAC system. We go to this particular federal officer who accesses his higher chain of command, which in this case is 5th United States Army in San Antonio, Texas. And that's where he would go. So we can run it up that chain. He's there every day. We have him every single day. And he does a lot more than just wait for emergencies, obviously,
right?
Because we have to deal with the active component every single day on everything we do.
All right, I'm going to move on. Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a perfect lead into my question. What General, I'm going to have to call you Colonel General.
That's all right.
Yeah, Colonel General. What percentage of your budget is from the federal government?
Roughly 98%.
Sir. 98%. That's a perfect lead into the question. When our troops were down in Louisiana, who was it that removed the guns from the law-abiding private citizens who were attempting to defend their community and their person?
Madam Chairman, Senator George, you're talking about citizens of Louisiana, the local citizens
that had their guns taken away.
Well, Senator, the only thing I can, and I'm not familiar with exactly what you're speaking to, but we were automatically under the rules of engagements established by the governor of the state of Louisiana. I can't speak to this precisely, but somewhere in that chain of command, I would guess between the city, the county, and the state of Louisiana, a decision was made to disarm those folks. And if our guys were doing what they should have been doing, they were following the orders that they were given under appropriate authority.
Madam Chair, that is the issue. I have a following another question, and that is, in this country, there's always been a very careful, very meticulous separation of these powers. We've always assumed that the purpose of the military was to kill people and break things. The Guard has been allowed to do other things, such as, you know, fight fires and other things like that. But when it gets right down to it, this is the federal government with 98% of the money in here that will, be in charge of major policing operations. Now, one of the things that I'm extremely concerned of, any of us who have ever watched the Waco video, and you've seen that on television several times, we remember the military helicopter coming in and firing on the facility. And that just gave a lot of us the creeps because it set the stage for a violent confrontation that ended in the death of many innocent children and women. So my concern is this. I think this is dangerous, and I'll tell you why. We had an opportunity a few years ago. I sat down with a couple of friends of mine that were guardsmen. At that time, they were receiving training in civil disobedience and organized how to go house to house. And I'm assuming this training is outside of the country, and they told me, no, it's for domestic operations. I think this is a tremendous step away from the separation of the state's policing or local jurisdiction operations, and now the federal government basically taking control of our policing operation. Please reassure me that that won't be the outgrowth of this.
Madam Chair, Senator George, under the laws of the United States, the National Guard is in the Constitution, and it says specifically in the Constitution that the militia will, in fact, be under the governor's control. And it also states that the states will select the officers of the militia. Under posse comitatus.
I don't believe that's what that says. And that's what worries me. Are you willing to join with me
to train a well-equipped and regulated militia. In other words, at the local level, we won't be waiting for you. We'll be knowing that we have folks in the local level who can respond with authority and training to deal with a local issue. Because I think this is a major confrontation on constitutional.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator George, in fact, it does, and it's not in the Second Amendment. It talks about the militia in the Second Amendment as well, and I'm not a constitutional lawyer, so I'm not going to sit here and pretend that I can give you exact words. But in essence, what it means is that we fall under the command of the governor, which is a local authority, local to the state of Oregon. We also accept money from the federal government under the Title 32 United States Code that says that the golden rule, he who has gold makes rules. But the Constitution is also very clear that it says the Congress will determine the discipline for the militia. So we're not fish or fowl in that respect. We're a very unique organization. But under what has been held by the courts of the recent court cases is that under posse comitatus, federal forces cannot be used to police American citizens. The governor, however, can use the militia, i.e. the National Guard, to use them to police the citizens of that particular state. So when you see these actions, like in Louisiana, and we've seen them before when we were looking for drugs up and down the coast, the active duty army came in, they got sued, they pulled out, because they don't have the right to do that under posse comitatus. And under the Constitution, the laws of the land so forth, that are in place today, the governor can use the National Guard. We do work right now with state police to do those sort of issues. We don't arrest people. We don't supplant the police. We support them. In the case you're speaking to, which I'm not familiar with respect to the removal of firearms, again, we fall under the command and control of that particular jurisdiction under the rules of engagement that were agreed to by both governors. So in essence, we were Oregon troops on loan to the Louisiana governor, and we used those rules of engagement to exercise their desire. It's the best I can tell you. Now, when it comes to setting up the militia, we are the militia. We don't need to set up a separate militia. We have both a federal and state militia, and we have the State Defense Force that Representative Krupp just brought up a few minutes ago that is established here in the state that does not require a federal sanction in order to be involved in it. A state-ruled, state-owned, state-managed. And it's also state-funded, which is 100% of their funds, which last year I think was $5,000, maybe $10,000. So, again, we do have what you just asked for, which is a local militia.
Madam Chair, just right. One follow-up. On the second page of the description of how this transition is going to occur down under stage two, it says this: the Oregon Military Department and the Department of State Police enter into an interagency agreement that transfers personnel and budgetary responsibility for these divisions, state police divisions, to the Oregon Military Department. I mean, if that doesn't look as if this new operation will in fact have fingers and go into everything in which the public might have had more confidence that they had constitutional protections because of the local sheriff regulation, the local state police regulation, but now that being interwoven with the military department.
Madam Chair, Senator George, I can answer that one. If there were to be any steps that would put this arrangement in place during the interim before the legislature met, you can't actually operate without budgetary authority. So if there were going to be any sort of a transfer envisioned, it would have to be by interagency agreement. That's not saying that that has to happen or that it will happen, but if you did want to actually conduct the transfer, you would have to have state police saying, we are entrusting Oregon Emergency Management and the budget that we have for them over to the oversight of the Oregon Military Department. That's the only way you could do it.
Right, but in stage one that talks about the governor doing all of this by executive order, we would be backing up and then permanently placing these personnel under the authority of the military department. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator George, not budgetarily, because only the legislature can act budgetarily. And in that, they would be the only ones under that budget who would be able to designate somebody who's currently a state police employee as a Oregon Military Department employee. The limitations of an executive order is as long as the authority that is granted under the, and granted, I'm an attorney, but not in this area, the authority that the legislature grants by statute cannot be changed by the governor. He may be able to restructure it in a fiction that has it carried out in a different way as long as the legislative intent is met. So that's why you would have to have both an executive order and an interagency agreement, and that's one of the reasons why we're here. The governor's not interested in doing that unless he has buy-in and agreement by this body and as we go into the legislative session from the legislature as a whole.
Correct. But you're also speaking of if it would occur in the interim.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
If it doesn't happen in the interim, then of course none of that needs
then
to
then none of that's necessary. I'm going to move on, Senator Marcet, and then Senator Gordlick.
Tell me about the Governor's Security Council.
Madam Chair, Senator Marcet, the Governor's Security Council was set up by executive order in the same document that created the Office of Homeland Security. And then under House Bill 2101 by the legislature during the last legislative session and was placed under Oregon Emergency Management to provide Oregon Emergency Management and the Office of Homeland Security advice and counsel as to what they need to be doing to make sure that we are adequately prepared for emergency responses and both local and international terrorism as a possibility. One of the things that when we use the term Homeland Security in Oregon, we use a much broader term that really is what we call an all-hazards response, because most of the time, emergency responders are going to respond the same way to a terrorist attack as they would to a natural disaster, and so that's kind of the terminology there.
Who's on the Governor's Security Council?
Well, you had to ask me that, Madam Chair, members of the Senator Morissette. The list is in statute, and I can provide that to you if that would be helpful.
Madam Chair, there is a handout here by Galen Howard. I don't know if we're going to hear from Galen Howard, but he goes into part of a planning and starts out with the Governor's Security Council advising the various agencies. I assume that you guys are on the Governor's Security Council. Is that right?
I am, yes.
Can you shed light on the Governor's Security Council, Ken?
Well, Mike? Pretty good list here.
Madam Chair,
help you out.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, the members of the Security Council are four members of the Legislative Assembly, two of which are from the Senate appointed by the President of the Senate, two are from the House of Representatives appointed by the Speaker of the House, the Governor, the Adjutant General, the Superintendent of State Police, the Director of the Office of Emergency Management, and additional members appointed by the Governor who the Governor determines necessary to fulfill the functions of the Council, including state agency heads, elected state officials, local government officials, a member of the governing body of an Indian tribe, and representatives from the private sector.
Madam Chair, may I
follow up?
Now, this was established by the last legislature. Okay. Now, is it a sitting body currently?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I do not know if it has been fully appointed.
Seems like they would be doing the kind of work that we're doing. I mean, I hope there's not parallel groups working on something that we are not. I guess my question is, they're not functioning at the present time, right?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, no, they're in the appointment process, and they are not functioning body yet, so there's no duplication of effort.
Could you keep us informed about that?
Yes, sir.
Progress? Because it sounds like the Governor's Advisory Council would be a very important group in case when the emergency happens, they would be the ones who would probably come together.
All right. Senator Gordley.
Thank you. Just a few questions here. I would like to pick up on Senator Morissette's questioning. The Governor's Security Council would sit where on the...
Madam Chair, Senator Gurley, the Security Council traditionally has met at the call and the discretion of the governor when there's an emergency, and he can call them at his discretion. Most of the members who are on the Homeland Security Council are also on the Governor's Security Council. So there's a lot of duplication there. They obviously are not in an advisory role to emergency management. The Governor's Security Council is a direct advisor to the governor.
The Homeland Security Council is made up of what individuals?
Madam Chair, Senator Gurley, the members on that group are two members of the Senate, two members of the House, the Governor, the Adjutant General, the Superintendent of State Police, the Director of the Office of Emergency Management, and other members as the Governor deems appropriate.
Okay. All right. just to continue, you seem to be saying, the three of you, that you are convinced that the structure proposed will give us the most efficient response to whatever the situation or threat may be. That's what's included in the text that we have here. That's the language in the text in front of us. And may I ask who prepared this document? It's not noted where the document is coming from.
Madam Chair, Senator Gurley, I believe that was me.
Okay. All right.
Aha.
So
consider the source.
While you, the testimony I'm hearing says that you are convinced that this is the best structure, but do you have any reservations?
Madam Chair, Senator Gurley, and I assume you're asking me, they may have reservations as well. If there are any reservations, it really comes down to the changing nature of leadership. If in any of these major positions you have somebody who is unwilling or incapable to take action when action needs to take place, then you have a problem no matter where it is. I think under our current leadership structure, the people who are current adjutant general, Ken, Mike, the governor, are all people who, during a time of crisis, I have no doubt would be willing and able to take decisive action to make sure the citizens are kept safe or are made as safe as possible under the circumstances. Structurally, this design is most likely to result in that no matter what kind of leadership you have in place. If you have poor leadership, it really doesn't matter what your structure is. But at least this structure has some of the benefits of both the strengths that emergency management supplies, but also with the military side, because they have a long structured history and they have good connections with the federal government, that they're most likely to be successful during a time of emergency.
Well, Madam Chair,
follow up.
One of the things we know now and well from the experience with Katrina, and one of the things we know based on the national research, the redefining readiness study that I referred to earlier, is that it's absolutely critical to have agreements, intergovernmental agreements and understandings about structure and all that in place well before an emergency strikes. But I'm a little hesitant because what I want to see laid out more clearly are pros and cons and an independent analysis of the pros and cons. I appreciate the analysis that you brought forward, Mr. Campbell, but I'd like to ask our staff, if I may, Madam Chair, through the Chair, to prepare an analysis that gives us the pros and cons, but that we do that quickly as is possible. Again, feeling a sense of urgency about moving forward.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Gurley, and just to comment, reference your last question. I think, you know, there have been a lot of discussion about chain of command, chains of command, and I think one thing, regardless of what environment we work in on a day-to-day basis, there is a chain of command, whether or not you're flipping hamburgers at McDonald's or you're digging ditches for the city or the county or whatever the case may be. I think what we bring to the table with the National Guard and brings to the table with respect to this entire discussion, and Craig mentioned about, you know, the current structure and the current leadership, and we can talk about personalities. Mm-hmm. And I think we can all agree that there are certain personalities that we know and we have familiarity with that we're going to be comfortable with. But I think what we bring to the table, probably unlike a lot of different agencies, is that not only do we train young leaders, we train them at the lowest possible level you can imagine. What we're talking about is the E5 level, which is not even a shift supervisor at the McDonald's, but we train people at that level right up through our chain of command, to the lieutenants, to the captains, to the majors, to the colonels, that they understand leadership, they understand chains of command, they understand how to execute orders. And that's what we work on a consistent basis. This isn't something that you do once in a while. You do it every single day that you're operating in the uniform or doing what your task is. So I think what you bring is a big bench that you don't typically get with the typical bureaucracy is you've got a leadership bench that understands change of command and how to execute orders properly given. And I think that's where the advantage, one of the biggest advantages of, there are negatives to any change. I don't care how you cut it. There's going to be, there's change creates issues. It creates problems. It creates people's unwillingness to want to change. In our case, we see it every day. We change a lot. In the military, we're changing now. We just went through a reorganization, and we'll continue to do that. But we bring a bench that I don't think you can get any place else in any other agency.
I will say, Madam Chair, just if I may follow up and close,
right.
That I think I have a very good understanding of the quality of the bench, if you will, having served as chair last session of the Ways and Means Public Safety Committee. Our committee did a very thorough review of all of the agencies that are discussing and their relationships. So I have a great deal of comfort with the bench and the personalities on the bench. With that said, Senator George raised some issues, concerns through his questions that I'd just like to see us tease out a bit, and perhaps we can do that through the pros and cons approach of looking a little bit deeper here. And I'm not suggesting delay, because we want to be ready for whatever it is that's coming, and I want to make that part really crystal clear. Just very appreciative of the leadership that's sitting on that bench. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator Gordley. Representative Krieger.
Madam Chair, I have some concerns similar to what Senator George had talked about a minute ago, and I wouldn't be doubtful that this legislation is going to end up maybe in a committee I might be on. I can't recall the section, but I think it's Section 27 of the Oregon Constitution talks about the militia shall be subordinate to civil authority. I wonder how this fits in there. And then when that was written, after that, the 39th Congress, which was referred to as the Reconstruction Congress of 1866 to 1869, first section by John Bingham, who was a representative, talks about how they changed it from a collective political right, the right to be armed, and it had to do with the black people, whether or not they should be able to be armed to protect their homestead, family, and property. And in that, Congress changed it to a civil right. And the military, if they're going to be involved in this, and you're going to get things through any committee I've got, that's got to be real plain. Who has the rights? And that this, and we're not going to have the military getting on top, out front, involving these types of issues.
Okay. Other questions at this end of the table? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see in the material as a reference to budget impacts that will be pursued in the next session. In the main, it looks like the proposal is to sort of reorganize without adding anything cumulatively to the total effort. It's just a question of where the chain of command comes down. And I would say on the surface, it would seem the logic of putting that in the military department is pretty significant. There's a reference to budget impacts. There's also a reference to the Oregon Wireless Interoperable Network. Is that the only budget impact that will be pursued, or are there staffing increases that will result that we'll be looking at next session to make this come about?
Mr. Chair, Representative, Madam Chair. My asset's not that bad. Madam Chair, Representative McPherson, in answer to your first question about the budget in general, there will not be specific budgetary costs associated with transitioning this over. There may be budgetary impacts for supporting the Homeland Security and emergency response to a level where they can do their job adequately. Unfortunately, over the last several decades, both the military department and the emergency management division, wherever it happens to align, have had the unenviable task of being the people that cry wolf. Unfortunately, if you have to do that long enough, people don't take you seriously, and that often follows along with budgetary support. And so what will likely happen is there will be some recommendations that are not critical to the transition, but will be critical to making sure that the state of Oregon is adequately prepared to respond to emergencies. communications being part of that.
Public affairs.
Correct. So there are going to be some issues that will be brought up during the budget. They will not be critical to making or breaking a transition of emergency management to the military department. There will be, obviously, separate discussions that will happen with the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network, and again, there is a group following us that can talk about that more, that will certainly have budget discussions that will need to take place. But those will not be part of the discussion about the transition from of emergency management into Homeland Security, or into the military department. Did I answer your question?
You did, although I have a follow-up on a really related question, if I could, and that is, one of the functions being performed here is accessing federal funds that come under the general flow of Homeland Security grants. Is there anything about moving these functions into the military department that will either have an enhancing or a negative impact on our qualification for federal dollars? Is that either a positive, negative, or is it neutral?
Madam Chair, Representative McPherson can back me up on this or change based upon what I say. Because there are already a number of states fluctuating between 20 and 21 that currently have a structure where emergency management is under the military department, and the current administration's support of the military for doing these sort of things, I don't anticipate you will see a detrimental effect on Homeland Security funds coming to the state as a result of the transfer. It may enhance our capability depending upon whether or not our ability to match state military assets to what we're doing with emergency management, whether they take that into consideration. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they do that or not, because we've never been able to make that claim in Oregon.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. In the essence of time, I'm going to have Senator Carter close with the last question.
It's really not a question. It's a statement, and please know that before I make it, I'm biased toward present seated people. That Senator Gordley was talking about an article that was written by, what's the name of the group, Senator Gordley?
The Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies.
Right. Part of what they were saying, of many of us are at risk. With Hurricane Katrina, the people who suffered and died in New Orleans were predominantly poor, African-American, infirm, and elderly. Many of these people could not evacuate from the city on their own. In 2003, a Louisiana State University survey predicted that this would be the case, and we know some of the reasons why. Number one, lack of transportation. Number two, lack of money for gas and lodging, impaired mobility, and concerns about looting. Well, I am very proud to say that the general sent a lot of people from Oregon to Louisiana, and the area that was most devastated was, the Ninth Ward. The Ninth Ward was all black, poor. People couldn't get out of there. So I just got a call from Louisiana, from the president of the organization where I'm chairing a committee that's going to be held here June 29th through July 1st, and the national office just advised me that a national award from Noble Women will be awarded to the Oregon National Guard for its work in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Oh, great. Yeah. All right. Thank you, Senator Carter. Thank you very much for being here today and for your presentation. And next on our agenda is the Statewide Communications Interoperability Report. And here to give that report is Marla Ray. Yes.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to have her give us a report on the commercial crab pot limit first.
Oh, I'd be interested in that myself. So,
hoping that Senator Carter's bias toward currently seated people is continuing and contagious. My name is Marla Ray. I am one of two co-coordinators for the State Interoperability Executive Council. My trusty sidekick is Steve Marks, who is in the back of the room. We work closely with Oregon Emergency Management, Ken Murphy, and his shop, as we have since the inception of the State Interoperability Executive Council. I also am not certain if I heard correctly, but did Mike Caldwell mention that Union County was went through a disaster when he was a county commissioner. Is that what he said, or did I miss something on that? I wasn't sure. Okay. That's enough of that. That's just enough of that. I was requested by your staff to provide the committee with an update on the activities of the State Interoperability Executive Council when, as I listened to the conversations earlier in Representative Boone's scenario, when the bridge is out, when the utility's out, when Senator Cruz's property becomes oceanfront property, it's the State Interoperability Executive Council's concern that the public safety first responders that assist with those incidents and those events can effectively talk to each other. Talk to the hospitals, talk to the utilities. Moreover, and I think more basic is this, that need to effectively communicate is day to day, and it is right now. It is not reserved for those times when we have a tsunami, an earthquake, a wildfire. It is day to day communications needs, and those needs exist today. That's what the SIEC cares about. In House Bill 2101, this body made a series of legislative findings concerning the state of our communications systems and network and infrastructure. In the course of establishing the SIEC, which is local government driven, chaired by a local fire chief, Jeff Johnson from Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, made up of chiefs of police, sheriffs, fire chiefs, special districts, 911 public safety answering point managers, special districts otherwise, and state agencies, but it is local government driven. When this body put it in statute after 3 years of operating under gubernatorial executive order, you assigned it two tasks. One was to work with the state in developing the what is called the Infrastructure Replacement Plan. That has become known as OWIN, or the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network. The second thing that you directed the SIEC to do was to develop the Oregon Interoperable Communications Plan, the goal of which is to achieve statewide interoperability within 6 years. That's the deadline provided to all of the states and jurisdictions by the Federal Communications Commission on some pretty significant mandates that are coming up in the year 2013. The Interoperable Communications Plan has been assigned by the SIEC to its Strategic Planning Committee. The Strategic Planning Committee already has adopted, and I've previously provided to this committee, I think, in an earlier presentation at your first meeting, the punchlines of that strategic planning that involve leadership, technology, and partnerships among the multiple jurisdictions and disciplines. The Strategic Planning Committee met at the conclusion of our last monthly meeting and outlined the work that it has ahead of it. Because it's a good place to start for everybody, and that's to define statewide interoperability so that everybody is on the same page, so that we all agree on what it means, thus we know when we've achieved it. We're going to have some sample definitions to give to folks, because the definition out there varies widely throughout the states. We want to just simply make certain that everybody here agrees with what we're talking about. We're going to view this in the global sense. It's not operability within state agencies. It's not operability within regions, but it is, in fact, for the where all of the public safety first responders and others with whom they work statewide. We aren't operating in the development of this plan from scratch. We don't need to reinvent the wheel, in large part because SAFECOM, an adjunct of the Federal Department of Homeland Security, and it came out of an earlier group, as well as, you know, whether it's Orange County, Florida, whether it's the state of Virginia, many others have already divined their communications plans. We're going to pick the best of each of those and organize those. In addition, the National Governors Association has had a task force working on this for some time, so we'll pick and choose of the things in there. At our next meeting on June 13th, we will be roughing out the work plan that will form the components of the interoperable communications plan, incorporating those elements in the existing strategic plan. One of the committee members here mentioned earlier the involvement of federal agencies. Our chair, Jeff Johnson, has been in contact already with the United States Attorney, representatives of Oregon's congressional delegation to assist us in pulling together those relevant federal agencies to participate in this statewide planning process. Naturally, they work together and plan and prepare at the local level, whether it's the Douglas County Sheriff's Office with the local office of the BLM or the U.S. Forest Service, but we'd like to have that a bit more formalized at the state level and pulling together the regional plans. In addition to that, Ken Murphy serves as a member of what's called the Federal Executive Committee, which are a good number of the relevant federal agencies that get together once a quarter. So we have our hooks into the federal agencies through those three avenues. I committed to being brief. At this point, I guess one thing that I'd mention, Mr. Campbell, in his presentation, made reference to the organizational placement of OWIN not going with the Oregon Military Department, and mentioned that OWIN right now is organizationally within the Oregon State Police. I think folks have made clear that that is that what we're saying is at this stage, because what we're attempting to do is to stand up that organization. It is the first part of the SIEC's work with emergency management and many of the other state government players. You may know, and you've heard either in this committee or in JCLIMT or some of the others' presentations on OWIN, how much money we're talking about in the long haul and giving folks sticker shock along the way. We're working on the financing of those. That's one of the requirements that we come back to this body with in January of 2007. Where it lands ultimately, I think it's still a matter of discussion. What we are obviously hoping for on behalf of the SIEC, really simply two things, and that's stability and support. So with that, Madam Chair, I would be more than pleased to answer any questions, so long as it does not include crab pot limits.
Well,
not
thank
from my perspective,
you,
Senator.
Thank you, Marla. I hope that as the questions go along, we become a little bit more specific, just for my benefit.
No problem.
I will say that, and then I'm going to turn it over to Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the discussions we had this morning in our subcommittee was some of the lessons learned from both 9/11 New York City and from Katrina in regards to capability of wireless. One of the lessons learned was that text messaging worked extremely well when other components of wireless communications were simply unusable because of capacity issues and so forth. So what we sort of talked about this today, and I think we're going to explore future the opportunities for people to access the 911 communications system with text messaging. And that's going to take some thought. There's a new generation of people in America today, typically our kids and our grandkids, that are utilizing text messaging as never before. And I think that for us to ignore that as an effective means of emergency communications is a mistake. So I would urge you, have you talked about that as a component of interoperability, and is that going to be a piece of the puzzle that you're going to try to put together when you talk about organizing this potential system?
Chair Verger and Representative Krupp, I think it is fair to say that at this point everything is on the table. There is underway, as we speak, an engineering survey and design component being put together by a company called Federal Engineering under contract with Emergency Management to do the what is underway right now is a survey of all of our sites, whether it's text messaging, whether it's cell phones, whether it's Wi-Fi, whatever, microwave. What we are working on right now is the infrastructure for all of those technologies to operate. The sites, the locations, the towers, the stability of those towers, the buildings, the security of those buildings, that basic infrastructure for all of those kinds of technologies to operate. One of the things that we found out from lessons learned, and Ken Murphy is a wizard in this area, is in all of those earlier disasters around the country, the biggest challenge for folks is the communications through whatever method, whether it's text, whether it's cell phone. Oregon, in what we've learned so far from the engineering firm, is what we already know in large part, the diversity of our state. Where are towers located? Who owns the property? Do we have opportunities for co-location with local governments? Do we have opportunities to partner with a private telephone carrier? So we're at the very core, ground level, if you will, literally, of that site survey statewide for the state agencies that will then help in the design for what the system looks like. Long answer to a very simple question, and the simple question is everything's on the table. Nothing's been excluded. There are some that have suggested to us that cellular phones and satellite phones and Wi-Fi are all, you know, OnStar are all opportunities. They are all opportunities, but they all operate under different ways, and not one is perfect for all of the state because of the diversity of our geographic valleys, mountains, hills, flatlands, and the like. That survey, Madam Chair, will be done and available to the state in October. The engineering firm that's doing that will then be available to the state to help draft the RFP that will be necessary for the build-out of the system. Big, complex, expensive.
Mm-hmm. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've heard of Wi-Fi. I have no idea what it is. If somebody sent me a text message, I wouldn't know how to access it. So obviously, I'm not a kid anymore. But I also come from a part of the state, southwestern Oregon, where there's more black holes than probably in space. So truly, if we're going to have a seamless wireless system, we got a lot of money to spend. I mean, an incredible amount of money to spend, and you know that. So, Douglas County just had a dry run. What, 3 weeks ago, I think, something like that, which they said was, quote-unquote, mildly satisfactory. My question is, are counties like Douglas moving ahead of the curve, or are they going, or are you coordinating with them so that what they're doing is going to fit?
There are, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, there are three separate but coordinated projects underway. The short answer to your question is yes, okay. Comma, hopefully. And let me okay. Answer that this way. There is in the metropolitan area of Portland an organization set up that's called UASI, Urban Area Security Initiative, designated by the federal government. It includes five counties, four in Oregon, one in Washington, Clark County. They have they're pretty far along. They have a consultants on board to help them with communications planning, not just for each of the five individual counties, but for the entire UASC five-county operation. That is not site surveying as we're doing at the state level. There is a second group out there, and funded through, these are all funded through Homeland Security funds, by the way, federal grants. There is another group out, RCC Consulting, which is doing 11 county planning projects. Each of those counties had put in for grant funds to help them develop their county plan, because that's a requirement for federal grants. Rather than have 11 counties go out and hire someone to do their planning, they all glommed on together and coordinated, and this one firm is doing those plans. And then the state's engineering plan that's underway. We have those, all of those contractors coordinated. It is our hope that what we can do at the end of the day is, as those regions evolve and develop, our job becomes pretty simple. We take, because Ken Murphy has pounded into us forever and ever and ever, all emergencies are local.
Mm-hmm.
They respond here, and then everybody calls for help. So rather than us going in and saying, here's what you're doing, hopefully our role is to coordinate and facilitate what folks are doing locally and providing the backbone and the infrastructure, the standards and the protocols for them to be able to do their jobs.
Additional question, Madam Chair?
Yes, follow up.
Thank you. Well, it's not quite a follow-up, but my concern at this point would be the 911 system, which we had quite a battle over two sessions ago, the move to regionalize and the need to keep the smaller systems where people know what roads they're talking about, things like that. And 911 does come into this. What I mean is the future of these small sub 911 systems in jeopardy in this? Are you looking at more of a regional structure, or is the integrity of the system going to be maintained?
There are about three questions in there, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, and I want to take the last one first. The SIEC itself has no intention, has no interest in disrupting anything to do with the operations of 911 centers or public safety answering points, the number of them or how they're funded. That's the short answer.
Okay.
We're aware, and some of our members are painfully aware of the issues with consolidation of PSAPs from some years ago. We have bigger concerns within the SIEC than that issue. We'd like to make certain that folks are coordinating, communicating, and have the ability and the infrastructure and equipment to do that. Second answer to that is the SIEC's Finance Committee is a work in progress. It has telephone taxes, surcharges on other utilities as one of several options that they're looking at. Nothing, again, is off the table, but the SIEC and its Finance Committee is very, very much aware of the need to continue to fund, for the long haul, 911 centers, and has no interest in messing that up in any way.
Thank you. That's a comfort.
All right.
I just want to try to get this down to a very elementary understanding here. This is a communications plan for first responders. So you're looking at a plan that's going to help communication in times of disaster. Or are you talking about a wireless communication system that's going to be doing all kinds of other things if we never have a disaster?
Madam Chair, more the latter than the former. We need the ability now. We are operating with equipment that is old, at severe risk of failure, out of production, And if we don't, and that is a day-to-day need. It certainly will help in times of disaster. But what we're operating today is at severe risk of failure, and this body acknowledged that when it passed House Bill 2101 last session. Beyond that, the Federal Communications Commission has issued its mandate for states to go to what's known as narrowbanding by the year 2013. We are required to meet that mandate. We should be doing this without that mandate. This is a classic case, through nobody's fault, of deferred maintenance when you have a question of whether you're going to put a troop on the road or fix this radio or replace this radio. We all have a tendency to say we want the troop on the road. Now it's time for us to pay attention closely and give them the tools that they need to communicate, to save the lives of people and their property, as well as themselves, when they are on the road.
Okay. I appreciate that. And I really believe it's a little bit like motherhood and apple pie. I just don't believe most people want them to have old equipment and not be able to communicate. I think we're very safety-minded, not only in this body in the legislature, but in the public. But let's talk about this plan. Will there be several plans? Will there be a basic plan? Or are we just going to get a Cadillac plan that's going to be terribly expensive without understanding that there are other ways of doing it?
Madam Chair, I wish I could definitively answer that today without the benefit of further work by the Strategic Planning Committee in fleshing that out. It is hard for me to say what the elements of that plan will be. Remember, there are two things that we're doing. One's the infrastructure replacement plan.
Right.
The other is the communications plan to achieve statewide interoperability within 6 years. That one will probably include, the protocols, the channel designations, frequency management plans, those kinds of things. The infrastructure replacement plan, taking into account Oregon's diverse landscape and existing state of affairs, the preliminary estimate from the engineers, and subject to change and refinement when we get their report in October, is over time $500 million. For the infrastructure, the towers, the sites, the buildings, all of that. We are looking to have half of that funded by the federal government. So the state of Oregon share of that would be $250 million. Working with the Transportation Commission, keep in mind, and I think I may have forgotten to note this at the very beginning, the state agencies that are very active in their work together involved in this include the Oregon Department of Transportation, the Oregon State Police, the Forestry Department, and the Department of Corrections. Right now, each of those agencies is operating its own independent radio system. We said some time ago that it makes more sense and little will, if you will, by this body to fund four independent state radio systems. Let's have them coordinate and work together. So that's what the state infrastructure design team is all about. But back to the funds on that, the $250 million for the state portion over time could be reduced by $75 million with three $25 million shots by the Oregon Transportation Commission. Gets us down to $165 million. Steve Marks is staffing the Finance Committee, which is chaired by Clark Seeley from the Oregon Department of Forestry. They're running numbers on debt service, certificates of participation, trying to figure out some of those costs for presentation, because you directed us to come back with one or more financing options. by January 2007.
I think I'm driving you to be specific. If I leave Coos Bay and drive to Salem, when I get to Reedsport, if I turn down 38, I've lost my communication until I come to I-5. If I go to Florence and decide that I'm going to come through Mapleton, I've lost my communication system. Then when I get to Corvallis, I've lost it again, except within the city limits. Are you trying to, in this infrastructure study, fix it where I have communication? Just average citizen now has communication along all these roads. Or are we talking about the state police and local officers or first responders in a disaster having the ability to have communication statewide?
Madam Chair, our focus is on the latter. Our focus is on the public safety in the global sense, public safety first responders and others with whom they work. If so, it wouldn't, we're not out there to help Marla or Joanne or Jeff or Steve or Harry have better cell phone coverage. We want Officer Jeff, Firefighter Steve, Ambulance EMT Marla to have their abilities to communicate to save citizen Joanne and to help her. That's what we're focused about.
Okay.
If, on the other hand, at some point, when we decide if we're going to co-locate and if we're looking at public-private partnerships, if we have a tower site, if we do as Utah did, which is to lease out part of that site to a private company, it may be your cell phone carrier, and that may improve your coverage.
Which?
But that's not our focus.
Which could save my life.
Could. Very much so.
If there is an accident after I leave Mapleton,
yep,
when I have no coverage and I'm severely injured, I would not be able to communicate, and it might not be an officer just riding along the road. So it would be safe. I'm just trying to get very specific here so that when people ask questions of us about what your goal is, and particularly when you talk in terms of millions of dollars, you have to have all the answers for the average person.
I agree with that, and I appreciate that. We have found out through a lot of work on this that there is a belief by members of the public today, not just in this state but throughout the country, that police officers and firefighters and EMTs and utility companies and hospitals and schools all have the ability today to communicate. Mm-hmm. That is the public's belief, certainly is their expectation. And we've not done a very good job explaining the reality of that, of what really goes on in the background in order for that to happen.
Thank you.
We will be in touch. We will continue to keep this committee posted along with the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology, where OWIN and those components report on a regular basis. We will, through your staff, keep this committee posted on the evolution of the State Interoperability Executive Council's communications plans, and more than happy to respond to any inquiries in the meantime.
Other questions? Let me see. Is there anybody? No.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, Marley talked about the four state systems, and then you start talking about EMTs and ambulances, and which gets down to all of the local systems that every county that's got their own system thinks it's absolutely perfect and wonderful and everybody should merge with them. And I mean, which is a whole, I mean, you're talking about what it's going to cost to get these four state systems merged into one, but then there's got to be, I mean, do we have any idea of the price tag of that next, going down that next level, which is absolutely vital in this?
No, not
that,
yet.
Is that in the that isn't in the dollar figure you're talking about?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, not at this point.
Okay.
One of the things that the engineers will do when they figure out the sites and the overlap of the coverage and all of that, the SIEC itself has been working on what incentive we could provide to a local jurisdiction to hook into the state system.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than build this and mandate that they come on, won't work. What the SIEC has said is that we will plan for a system of systems. That is, if you have something that's working as Ducky in Douglas County, something that's working fine in the Portland metropolitan area, what can we do to hook those up, those two systems up, and become that system of systems up and down the corridor, over to the east side, down to southwest? We spent some time last month with the state of Utah, had their executive director of what would be the equivalent of OWIN come up here and make a presentation to the state SIEC. They do, and they're, you know, one-third the size of the state of Oregon, and certainly a far less population. Their system was pretty sizable in its expenses. Because of the Olympics, when they were getting set up down in Salt Lake City, the federal government paid a fair amount of that. But the locals that got into that one really are paid user fees based on the number of radio sets that they have. That's another option, you know, like a utility. And it's set up organizationally within state government as a semi-independent agency run by, in essence, a board of directors. So that's another opportunity that we might be looking at here. That's on our to-do list later on as soon as we get some of our other work done.
Other questions? All right. Marla, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Madam Chair. Again, we'll stay in touch with Judith, and we are prepared to respond to any questions you or members of the committee may have.
All right. Thank you. All right, it's time now for us to look at some of the things we're going to be looking at. Our next meeting is July 25th here in Salem, and we're going to be talking about law and order during the disaster, and that would be state, county, district, and city liaison. The community subcommittee will also be taking some of this under consideration. One of the things we're going to run into that we're going to have to work through, because it's not going to be easy, and that is every city, town, and hamlet has their own ideas locally of how they want to perform. And we all appreciate that, recognize that, respect that. And so we need to be sure that as we develop plans, that they somehow overlay with the majority of what the local people are trying to do.
Hmm.
We're going to review the legal obstacles that are going to face us, which, even though we have a great idea, they're going to have to tell us whether we legally can do it or maybe legally shouldn't have it accomplished. And then we'll possibly be talking about some draft requests to the Legislative Council. So as we move through the summer, we're going to be coming down the pike here and getting ready for legislation. And we'll have a new report, probably from maybe from your committee.
Mm-hmm.
And as we get finished with these subcommittee reports to the General Committee, we'll begin to refine it. This is not going to be an easy task, and Judith will have to be of great assistance to us in helping us work through some of just the language part, as you can already see by the first subcommittee report. Chairman George says, well, I think this is our report. So we're going to have to work through that. And today was good work. Any comments for the good of the order here? Or
one really quickly. From the piece that on Focus magazine handed out by Senator Gordley, there's a statement here that I think is so important. Citizens should be part of the first responder team. We keep talking about what government was going to do, but all of us right here agree that this is really a case of education. We've got to prepare our local communities.
Other comments, Madam Chair? All right.
Just really appreciating our staff. Judith, you do great work and really appreciate the way that you get back to us so quickly with information and requests. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Gardley. Judith, would you like to go over the schedules?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Just as a simple reminder, I just wanted to make sure we have all the dates on the calendars. For the full joint committee, our next meeting, as Senator Berger mentioned, will be July the 25th. That will be an afternoon meeting like this one, since the Natural Disaster Subcommittee will be meeting that morning. August 22nd will be a full day, and that is when the committee will receive all the final recommendations from the subcommittees, and you'll be able to walk through there, fine-tune those, make sure we have implementation responsibilities delineated and that sort of thing. And September the 26th is when you will further fine-tune and look at hopefully some perhaps draft language, make sure all of the committee's final legislative concepts are approved and in for drafting. Leadership would like us to be ready to file a pre-session file anything you wish by October.
And that's a full day.
That's a full day on the 26th. If you happen to sit on the Community Response Subcommittee, that next meeting will be July 11th in Pendleton. Looks like that meeting will be in Pendleton. And you will not have to worry about transportation, as the military department is going to fly the subcommittee from Salem to Pendleton and back to Salem that same day.
You want to take me to Gold Beach?
Talk to General Caldwell about that.
I've got a nice purse.
If you sit on the Serious Events Subcommittee, that next committee meeting will be on July 13th in Portland, likely at the Port of Portland. And as I mentioned, the Natural Disaster Subcommittee will be meeting the morning of July 25th. That'll be the last meeting for that one. So, thank you, members.
Okay. I want to thank the committee today for the good discussion and for the seriousness at which you are addressing this serious situation that we have in Oregon. I greatly appreciate it. And I also, I'm sure all of you know, but the reason that co-chair Brian Boquist was not here today is that he's back in the military for a short little brief time. I think he's one of these interesting people that informs his wife that he's going to be out of town but doesn't say where.
I can't get away with that.
I know, it's the job that all of you really wish you had.
So,
but we missed him today, and I missed him today, and I look forward to his return.
Exactly.
All right. Thank you very much. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.
I didn't hear it.